And the first bill I want to try to deal with, if I can.
If you can.
Yeah, never mind. Senator Brown, you're here. Let's start on 2352. And you're here for a host of these. You want to just chat about all of them at once?
Would that be okay, Mr. Chair?
You bet.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7. And for the committee's information, I know you heard one of the juvenile code rewrite bills last week. It was House Bill 2392. But you have before you today a package of the four remaining bills, House Bill 2611, House Bill 2355, House Bill 2388, and House Bill 2399, which, if I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce each one of them very briefly. I did want to give you a background of how this juvenile code rewrite group came to be, and that is we were a byproduct of both the Interim Judiciary Committee and the Oregon Law Commission's sort of decision that we needed to spend some time working the juvenile code, both the dependency and the delinquency side during the interim. I think we did a good job on the dependency angle this past interim. The group is approximately 40 people. We have lawyers, judges, district attorneys, folks from SCF, folks from the Department of Justice, so a variety of folks that we believe represents the numerous players in the juvenile court system. We met on a monthly basis. We were extremely grateful when the Oregon Law Commission obtained funding so that we could receive staff assistance from the Oregon Law Commission, because it was absolutely critical to our efforts. But these bills are a consensus product of the work group. I do believe that there will be folks testifying against one of the bills. So they do not, everybody did not love every single word that we crafted, and actually they have been changed a little bit over in the House side as well. So with that introduction, I'll start out with House Bill 2611, and this, Mr. Chair, is actually what I think is the most important bill. And what it does provide is rules of juvenile court procedure for dependency proceedings. And I just wanted to relay this little piece from the executive summary. Imagine playing a board game in which each player is given a different set of rules. While some sort of game may ensue, the outcome is completely unpredictable and the participants are frustrated. Even if this imaginary game is eventually governed by only one set of rules, suppose those rules are for Monopoly and the board on the table is for checkers. In that instance, even though the rules are certain, they simply just don't work. The situation for the participants is not very much improved. And I see frowning looks, but for those of you who have ever been involved in juvenile court proceedings, you will understand that this is completely the case. We have no set of rules.
Senator Duncan.
I was the one frowning. I was just thinking of playing Monopoly with my grandchildren.
Yes.
There are lots of different rules.
Yes, exactly. Well, then you will understand that in our juvenile court dependency proceedings, the rules basically have varied from case to case and from county to county, so that I can practice mostly in Multnomah County. Basically, rules could be very different if I went to Clackamas County, so I stayed in Multnomah County. And the courts can use the statutory procedures of the Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 419B, and the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, or a combination of both. And recently there was a court case on this issue that said that the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure do apply to juvenile court dependency proceedings. However, as for those of you familiar with juvenile court proceedings, the Rules of Civil Procedure don't exactly help in some instances in terms of moving the process along in an effective and timely manner. So this is our work group product. We believe they promote process predictability, timeliness, and administrative efficiency in the juvenile court dependency cases. I believe that Julie McFarland is here. She's not here. Kathy Osborne. Oh, lucky Kathy. Julie and her work group spent an enormous amount of time crafting this work product. There was at the outset some concerns raised from the bench, some of whom spent a lot of time in the issue of juvenile court and others who did not. We worked very closely, the work group worked very closely with Judge Deanne Darling, who does the juvenile caseload in Clackamas County, to address the plethora of concerns from the judges. I believe we have addressed those concerns, and the bench is, feels comfortable with the product that we have crafted. So Kathy Osborne will come forward on House Bill 2611. The couple of the other bills, House Bill 2355 clarifies when and where a post-adjudicative action for relief may be brought without altering the juvenile court's authority to set aside or modify orders. Right now, the current juvenile code is unclear where and when a post-adjudicative action for relief may be brought. Michael Livingston will be testifying on that particular bill, I believe. House Bill 2388 provides for a notice of appeal in juvenile court proceedings, and it would require a trial counselor to file notice of appeal after a final order if their client requests them to do so. And I know the chair has asked for specific examples. The case that this came in front of me was that I had a client who wanted appeal from the trial court ruling that terminated her parental rights. I did not handle appellate cases. My appointment ended the day the termination ended. So I got frantic calls from her newly appointed lawyer about when the judge's order was filed that affected the 30-day notice to require her to file a notice of appeal. I believe in that case her new attorney did actually get the notice of appeal filed within the 30-day time frame, but I know this is an ongoing problem for juvenile dependency appellants and their 30-day notice and when they're dealing with court-appointed attorneys. And then lastly, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2391 clarifies and codifies what we believe should be current practice requiring parents who have some confusion about the court's, I can't remember the name of the agreement, that the parents are required to comply with as part of their agreement with SCF and the juvenile court in terms of bringing the case to closure. When a parent doesn't feel like he or she can comply with that agreement, he or she needs to inform the court immediately and work out a different order or a different arrangement with both the agency and the court. And then I mentioned House Bill 2392 passed out last week. And with that, I will conclude and let, as my good colleague from Salem would say, all these certified smart people testify on these bills. Mr. Chair, any questions?
No.
Okay. No questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, we do have one technicality, and I don't know if this can be done, but my understanding is that Roger Beyer is the carrier on 2392, which was sent out last week. I would love to carry all of these bills if that's possible to have that happen. I couldn't come last week.
So you want to carry 2392?
That'd be great.
I don't think Roger Beyer will care.
I'm not sure he would. I'm not sure he has a passionate concern about this particular issue.
I'm sure he doesn't. I'm not confused.
For what it's worth, Mr. Chair, I do.
All right. Well, we'll make sure then you get assigned to carry.
Thanks.
At least that bill.
Pardon?
At least that bill, 2392, the one that's coming out. All right.
Thanks.
And already gone out.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think they will. I'm going to move out of the public hearing on the respective House bills and move to a work session on Senate Bill 294. This is the Interstate Compact and the other Interstate Compact, the Information Sharing Compact. Bill, do you want to tell us?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you heard this bill way back in the 28th of February when you had a joint meeting with the House Judiciary Committee on the other Interstate Compact as it relates to probationers and people on post-prison supervision. House Bill 294 enters Oregon into the National Crime Prevention and Privacy Compact. This compact sets forth how criminal history records can be used for non-criminal purposes. The bill defines non-criminal purposes as using criminal history records for crime prevention and other legitimate law enforcement purposes authorized by state or federal law, including but not limited to employment, suitability of license determinations, immigration, and naturalization matters, and national security clearances. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have two sets of amendments before you. One is the Dash 1, which I believe was as a result of a discussion that Ingrid Swenson had with Keith Cutler. Is that correct? Ms. Swenson is in the audience. Back at our 20th meeting in February. And then the Dash 2 amendments, which we just received today from Senator Burdick's office. And let me walk through the Dash 1 and then the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments would add at the very end of the bill a new section for the purposes of Section 2 of this 2001 Act, and that's basically the Interstate Compact, except for juvenile records described in 419A, 260, 1DJ, and that's basically records of any records, any cases under 419.1C, 005, in which the juvenile court has found a person to be in the jurisdiction of the court based on the person's commission of an act, which, if done by an adult, would constitute one of the following offenses, and it lists the offenses, basically a criminal act if it was committed by an adult. And what that does, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, going over to page 5 of the bill, page 5, subsection 2, the FBI, to the extent authorized by the Privacy Act and State Criminal History Records Repository, shall provide criminal history records, including all unsealed state criminal history records. So what that would mean for the purposes of our law, unsealed records would be just those at which a juvenile was adjudicated delinquent, so would not include other juvenile records. Then the Dash 2 amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they relate to page 1 of the bill. And what they do is they remove on lines 21, let me read how it would be if the language were included. Criminal history records means information collected by criminal justice agencies on individuals consisting of identifiable descriptions and notations, and then it would remove arrests, detentions, indictments, or other criminal charges, and any dispositions arising thereof, including acquittals, sentencing, corrections, and supervision. It would take out from arrest on, then it would take out acquittal, and it would substitute convictions of any disposition arising thereof. So I guess basically what it would be is it would allow criminal history records of convictions, but not of arrests and detention.
Does that depart from the compact to the extent that it would jeopardize our participation?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it does depart from the compact. Now, whether that's a fatal flaw would be something that, in my sense, it would probably be the only U.S. Supreme Court that could tell you that. I mean, what we have here is a interstate compact. If it's an interstate compact under the Federal Interstate Compact Clause, then if it's approved by Congress, it supersedes state law. But what we also have is a contractual arrangement among them between the parties. So it's then you get into the issue of how much can you vary from the contract. It would definitely raise some interesting points. Okay. I can't say it would necessarily be a fatal flaw. I mean, I think that's at this stage an impossibility. I'm sure the proponents would say that it would cause great consternation.
I guess the question I want to get to, and I don't know if OSP's in the audience or not, that at least the parties that were promoting this particular bill, but what I understood the issue to be was that we were already exporting a lot of this data to other states that request it, and the effect of the compact would be to allow Oregon to receive information of a like nature. So one question, I guess, in my mind is, if you adopt the amendments and restrict that information that you will export, will that also preclude the importation of other information that might be?
The Dash 1 amendment was made outside the compact. The Dash 2 is a change to the language that would be part of the compact. So what it does is it...
Yeah, it's a bad idea. You're making me vote for this stupid thing because of the compact, so you leave it alone.
Learning High Council Taylor, I can assume that if we are going to amend the compact for purposes, Oregon amends the compact in terms of what we say about it, that could negate parts of the compact in terms of other parties responding to us, other states. Is that correct?
It could, Mr. Chairman. It could. I mean, I can't say for certainty.
No, I understand that. I'm speculating that if we, in our own way, amend the compact for purposes, we can't amend it, but, you know, we're entering into the compact along these lines, that then could affect how other states react to us in terms of our soliciting and wanting information and things from them. Is that right?
It could, Mr. Chairman.
Otherwise, if you're a member, if we're all operating of or under the same compact, it pretty much binds us respectively. Is that correct, if I may say so? I mean...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Courtney, in the nature of a contract, if we all have the same language, then we definitely have a contractual arrangement. If we have different language, I guess it depends on whether it's materially different.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a good question. One could argue that this would be a material difference because the bill as it's written is talking about arrests, detentions, indictments, and the amendment would talk about basically convictions.
That is not true. If I have one final question, Mr. Chair, with the Northern High Council. One final question, please.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
That is not the case, though, with Dash 1. Dash 1 clearly is within the limits of the compact, correct?
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, the Dash 1 is an amendment outside. It does not amend the language in the compact. It adds a new section. And it was something that I believe that was worked out with the Department of Justice and Ingrid Swenson, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Ingrid's here. So my assumption is that Mr. Cutler, who represents the state police in this issue, feels comfortable with it. That's my recollection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. This is a work session.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a question on the Dash 2 amendments.
Yes.
Because I agree with the concept of the Dash 2 amendments, but I... obviously, we don't want to jeopardize the compact, but I guess I'm curious about what's the procedure of trying to get a change in the compact? And who, is there somebody here who can address that?
Sorry, what was the question again?
Well, my question, I don't want to jeopardize the compact, but if we wanted to have a voice in changing the compact, what's the methodology of doing that?
Well, I think...
Who sits in on...
Actually, Mr. Taylor can probably address that issue. Normally, there's like a national commission of some sort.
State
that,
police
that
involved.
That creates the basic language of the compact. And
Mr. Chairman of the committee, Senator Duncan, this is based on federal law. So you probably would have to start with Congress.
Okay, so it's a congressional kind of a thing.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. I mean, this is the beauty of it is it's an arrangement between the states based on federal law. If it's a proper subject matter, it is under the interstate compact law, so it arises at the level of federal law. The weakness is that it's hard to change by the individual states, but that's also the reason you have it. So,
well, I'm just saying, I don't know if a joint resolution or something like that might be appropriate to someone saying they this ought to, because I really do not believe that arrest or indictment should be floated around like that, because there are many errors in that, and people are arrested but not indicted nor convicted or anything else, and that still puts you on the record as I understand it now. Right?
Yes, it would.
Is that fair, Mr. Detective?
Well, I mean, Ingrid and I could argue about this, I'm sure. I think arrest information is very important in terms of it making a judgment with respect to whether or not a person should ultimately, say, be employed. But more than that is if you have someone who has an arrest in a particular area of law that might give rise to suspicion, say a person has been arrested for child molestation, they're seeking a job in a position in a function that might have access to children, it may give you at least the ability to start asking a few questions of that person with respect to the circumstances, or it might point you in a direction where you might get the copies of police reports. You might then seek out other witnesses and do further investigation to find out whether that person is suitable. There are a lot of reasons why things never go to trial that have nothing to do with whether they're innocent.
I might, Mr. Chair, I might have two candidates, and both equal, and I find that the word arrest shows up. That's going to be enough for me to throw that one out and go to the next one right away. Unfairly, maybe, but I think it's a fact of life.
That's where you get the big bucks.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had a candidate that ran against me that had that similar problem. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, the newspapers did.
I, too, as we talked about this originally, have concerns about the arrest as being part of this. And but my question would be that in the amendment that we've been offered by Ms. Svensson goes beyond that in the language. And I was just curious if it would be helpful for me to explain why she didn't just delete arrest. She changed the whole section there, if that's possible, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Yeah. Sure, we can spend a long time.
Well, I didn't ask to spend a long time, sir.
So we can. I'm just trying to be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senator Metzger, what was removed was all of the events which occur prior to a conviction. So an arrest, an indictment, and detention, all of those are pre-trial events. And so if the case gets dismissed prior to adjudication or if the person is acquitted, then none of these records would go if you adopted this amendment, and only the conviction and sentence.
I understand, but that's going farther than our previous discussion of arrest. I mean, there's more steps along the way that are erased from the record.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that's correct. That's correct. So if there were an indictment but no conviction, that would not be provided as well.
Thank you.
Okay,
yes, Mr. Chair, if I could I ask counsel, learn High Counsel, to review from me? I remember the night we did this. This was a very contentious point on the part of a certain member who no longer is in the legislature, as well as some others. How many other states have the compact with this language in it, this arrest type of language in it?
Chairman of the committee, I can't tell you how many of the states have adopted it, but I think that those that have adopted it, it would be pretty safe that they have this language.
Excuse me. So you don't know as we speak today whether or not this, of the states who adopted this language is in it or not in terms of what they've done?
I really can't tell you.
Okay.
If I could, Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, we were advised at the February hearing that 7 states had adopted it.
Okay.
As it is written here before us?
Yes.
All right.
Mr. Chair, can I have a question with counsel?
You bet.
Let's say we adopted these amendments, adopted this act, and passed it. They became, or even became a member. And subsequently, whoever these powers are decide that you didn't do it right. What is the net effect of that?
Counsel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this compact, Article 9, this compact binds each party until renounced by it. Renunciation of this compact must be effected in the same manner by which the state ratified the compact. So if we did it wrong, well, meaning everyone else did it wrong too, I guess we'll all have to renounce the compact for it to be no longer binding law on the state. It does have an out provision for us.
I mean, but that's just say the state of Oregon. They just didn't like what the state of Oregon did.
But see, there would be one other ramification. That's the only reason that the bill is actually back in front of this committee is that there is a fiscal impact if the state does not substantially comply with the federal act, and that is that when we go to do criminal history checks through the FBI system, if we haven't become a member of the compact, they're going to charge us an additional amount of money on top.
Right, that's basically the threat of the whole thing, is that they're going to start up on our prices for the FBI file.
Yeah, well, that's correct.
It's the typical kind of federal, we're going to help you, hire from the government, we're here to help you kind of thing. So, I mean, the question, I don't really care what we do with the bill. I really don't. If the committee doesn't want the bill, we'll kill it here. Next session, you know, you may be back with some additional charges and costs that are part of this thing, and I personally don't care. But I think that arrest information has a valid role to play in terms of evaluation of individuals as it relates to their character and their suitability for particular positions that they might be applying for. And we're really talking about the use of this information to make those kind of decisions if they're applying to become a teacher, if they're applying to become an SCF worker or somebody working with children, so on and so forth. But
well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm concerned about the person, and Ingrid brought this to my attention, it's one we've all heard of, the person, they went to the school and arrested the person. That was a false, it was a mistaken identity kind of a situation. And, you know, I mean, not even a suspect, just a mistaken identity. And yet that's going to show on his record as an arrest.
Exactly.
Now that part bothers me.
And if there is an investigation following up why that arrest occurred and the fact that it was false, it would show that it was false. And that would not be a barrier to employment. In other words, I guess what I'm telling you is it's not, well, this guy has an arrest, but we haven't bothered to look into the circumstances surrounding that and disqualify something based solely on the arrest. And it's an indicator that there's a place to go to look for additional information. In other words, I think we'd be in deep water if we precluded somebody from employment just because they had an arrest that we failed to follow up and do in due diligence on the reasons why. Because from time to time, those things do happen. But again, I don't really care.
How come you get lobbied by Ingrid, but she didn't lobby me?
All right. I sense no excitement about this bill.
I'm okay with the dash ones and the bill.
All right.
I'm not comfortable with the dash twos.
Vice Chair, I might get...
Well, I'm going to move the dash one amendments, then I'm going to take it. I'm going to see what happens on the dash twos, and then we'll just... Mr. Chair, why don't we just run it and then see what happens?
Because I'm kind of tired.
Okay, all right. Let me ask you this. What about the dash one amendments? Do you have a feel for that?
Because I'm fine. You want to move the dash?
I'd like to move the
Senator Courtney moves the dash one amendment.
294.
Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none.
I know you don't want the dash two amendments, that's for sure. So if it goes out, it's going to go out like this, or it's not going out, right? Yeah. So what I'm going to do is sit here real quiet and let somebody else make that motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 294 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Harper moves Senate Bill 294 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. How many objections I have? Any objections? No objections?
Yeah, I object. I object.
Senator. I'm going to not object for reasons that are very obvious. If I object, it's not going out, so I'll let it.
Okay, you can come up if you want.
No, I'm not going to do it here.
No,
I know this is more important to you than the other ones. I don't object to the way the bill is. I'll live with it, but I do. Don't hold it to me on the floor. I'm not going to object here. I'm struggling with the rest, you know that. I'm a yes on this thing that's going on.
All right, chair votes
no.
Dead bill. I'm not going to bring it back.
We'll suffer the consequences next session.
Dead bill.
All right. Since we're having fun here, House Bill 2352. Maybe we can kill another one here. Public hearing. Public hearing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Carter, and I'm a practicing lawyer here in town and also a member of the Oregon Law Commission. With me at the table to my right is Marcia Ole Miller of Bureau of Labor and Industries, and to my left is David Hendricks, Legislative Counsel. My comments are going to be very brief. I have a trial at 3, so I've got to get through here and run off, but I apologize for that. But you will have before you a written summary of the bill, which was prepared and adopted by the full Oregon Law Commission. And what I'm going to do is just limit my comments to process as opposed to the substantive matters and leave the discussion of the substantive matters to others, Mr. Hendricks and Ms. Ole Miller. Just in way of background, as early as 1999 legislative session, the Bureau of Labor and Industries identified a need to clarify Chapter 659, which is the Oregon Civil Rights Statute. The problem, in at least a brief statement of the problem, was that that chapter had developed over a number of different years and had been pieced together. There are some conflicting or confusing references within that chapter. So Legislative Council proposed to the Oregon Law Commission this project, and the Program Committee decided to take that on. The initial committee consisted of myself Mr. Hendricks, Ms. Ole Miller, and Bob Jundeff of the Oregon Advocacy Center, and Sandra Hansberger, who is also Oregon Law Commission member. We met and put together a draft of a bill. We circulated the bill for comments, and what you have before you, and that circulation including the Oregon State Bar section to get input from the Oregon State Bar and other business groups to get their input as well. And what you have before you is actually the draft after our work and also the circulation. The main goal that we had was to try to make this chapter a little bit more user-friendly. As you can imagine, this is a chapter that is used not just by lawyers, but by business people trying to identify what the law is in regard to their relationship with their employees. And that was one of the primary goals, is to put together a user-friendly or more user-friendly chapter that didn't necessarily require the assistance of a lawyer to go through and understand. We think we have done that. One of the primary, I guess, mantras through this whole process was we didn't want to make any substantive changes. We wanted to take the substantive law as it existed and put it in a form or fashion that was more user-friendly. And I'm just going to conclude my comments to that brief intro and just turn it over. Marcia, do you want to go first?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Oldemiller. I'm the legal policy advisor to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I participated in the work group on this bill. As far as background from Boley's perspective, over the years, a number of changes have been made to Oregon civil rights laws. Different protections have been added to the statutes, and they've become a lot, there's a lot more to them than there used to be. Along the way, as different substantive protections were added, some procedural things didn't get put in there consistently all the way through. So to give you some examples about what we saw over the years in trying to enforce the statutes, for instance, what we call aider and abettor liability, which allows enforcement against people who aren't necessarily the employer but who participate in discrimination, is available in some types of discrimination but not in others. Cease and desist orders, which are a tool of the commissioner to order a respondent to stop doing something that's been determined to be illegal, are available under some statutes and not others. And relief for retaliation for reporting civil rights violations are available under some types of discrimination and not others. And finally, the biggest piece to us is that Boley has jurisdiction over some violations but no authority to investigate them. We don't believe from looking at the statutes that any of this was intentional. It appears that with great enthusiasm, some protections were put in here and there, new things, but all the pieces weren't put in there to investigate and enforce those types of violations. So we, over the years, we've observed some of these things, tried to work around them as much as possible. In 1999, Commissioner Roberts approved Boley trying to introduce a sort of housekeeping measure to sort of patch the whole thing up with some bubble gum here and there and see if we could improve things that way. But Ledge Council suggested to us, and we knew they were right, that really reorganization of the chapter would be a really good idea to catch everything at once, make sure it was all really being fixed. And I think we were fortunate in that the Oregon Law Commission adopted that project as appropriate to their mission. And in my participation in the work group over the last year, I can say that this was a really thorough reworking of the chapter. Every attempt was made to keep it procedural, not substantive, and I really do think that we have fixed the problems to the best of our ability. So that's by way
of background.
Can I ask you
a couple of questions? I'm a little unclear as to what you just said. I mean, you said in certain circumstances things didn't line up. You didn't have the same authority in certain areas, but there was an assumption made that, gee, we ought to, or the legislature forgot this, or it's just kind of a byproduct of this process. And did you grant certain authorities where they weren't previously granted? I mean, is that what the bill does?
I would say that what we endeavored to do was to resolve ambiguities. It's, for instance, not likely.
But that's not the question. The question is, are there areas where you didn't have statutory authority to enforce or to investigate that in this bill you are giving or granting?
No, there's nothing over which Boley didn't have jurisdiction that is added in this bill. There are steps
I
in the...
I didn't say jurisdiction. I said the right to the privilege to investigate or...
Whether we've added something or clarified something, I suppose, I'd like Dave Hendricks to speak to those kinds of points. But we did not intentionally...
Trying to get clear in my mind is whether these were just areas of statutory law that were spread out in statutory law and you've just now reorganized everything and put it in a logical, sequential order, or if you have made some assumptions about certain enforcement actions or investigative powers and you've added investigative powers, enforcement actions, where you didn't previously have statutory authority.
It was reworked and reorganized, and to the best of our ability, we constructed what we believed from the language that was there and the history we could find to be the way these were supposed to be enforced, so that the enforcement is consistent for any type of violation. You have the same steps in investigation and the same things that the commissioner is supposed to do in the case of any alleged violation.
Okay, go back and tell me about the part of your testimony that said that you didn't have enforcement or investigative powers in certain circumstances. And then,
well, to give you a for instance, and I can't quote specific statutory parts now because unfortunately I didn't come prepared to speak to something that specific, but I can tell you that generally when a new statute was added or when, say, in a substantive statute, it will say, variously, it might say the Bureau of Labor and Industry shall have jurisdiction and nothing else, or it might say the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries has the same statutory authorities as for 659.010 to 110. And maybe when you look in those, in what's in 010 to 110, it refers specifically in the procedural things back to the substantive statutes, but it doesn't refer back to that particular substantive statute, so that you have that two-way link that, yes, this piece of the process does apply to this substantive thing over here that said that the Bureau had jurisdiction. That's just one example.
Okay. Senator Duncan.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just trying to kind of go along with you because I think I understand. I'm thinking of the education statutes. In many cases, there are laws written about what's supposed to happen, but there is no authority by anyone to make them happen. Now, by the way, in many cases, that satisfied me very well. I didn't want to bother with it. But I think what I hear you asking, are there places in the statute where there are things mentioned that talks about maybe you have the jurisdiction over it, but you have no authority to enforce it? And now are you coming back and saying, we want the authority to enforce? Is that your question?
It's kind of that.
Because it does change the nature of the statute.
I mean, I guess what I'm sensing you're telling me is that there was a lot of there were some assumptions about what the legislature either intended or didn't, or it seemed more logical that you would have it because the statutes were maybe silent on those issues. Now, I'm looking at Mr. Hendricks. Do you have any insight here? Could you help me?
Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. I should tell you, with respect to the Law Commission, we provide drafting services. Jeff elevated me to a member of the work group, and we don't sit in that function with them.
Which was my best decision.
We don't actually have any votes on any of the decisions. But that being said, I will say that I think that in these statutes here, I don't think there was anything in the chapter that provided for a complaint process through Boley. In other words, did not have a clear indication that Boley had that if you violated this particular section, that the, for instance, an employee's remedy was to file a complaint with Boley. There were a lot of other statutes out there. We had a lot of those that said you could file the complaint, and we had other statutes that talked generally about the jurisdiction of Boley, where there would be a whole bunch of sections that had gotten stuck in, but frequently, I suspect, in drafting, when they added in a new unlawful employment practice, they didn't go in and amend the section that talked about their general jurisdiction, and so that's where some of those problems are coming in, where they clearly were told you can go file a complaint, but some of the other conforming ones, talking about rulemaking authority and things like that, had not been amended. And in part, it was because of the way this chapter was drafted. There were so many little series of statutes and references where it had become very, very difficult, I think, for the drafters to work in this area, resulting in such things as the problem we had in 97, where in the process of rewriting the disability laws, we managed to lose the civil action and had to refix that then in 99. So I would say, and I think Marcia said this already, that you can't really do a clarification of a chapter. Jeff may have overstated a little bit in saying, gee, the work group, from what I could see, was trying to keep substantive changes to the rock bottom minimum, even to some things where some of the members wanted to say, we got to fix this. They were pretty reluctant. So they did seem to be guided pretty much by the impetus to try not to expand or contract Boley's authority, or to expand or contract the authority to go to court, which is the other half of it.
Well, I want to make sure that this committee has the ability to look at where there are some substantive changes by implication or whatever else, because there was an assumption that this ought to be the way it is, but the statutes are not really clear that at least we understand those policy questions, and just the committee, the legislature, agrees with what you've done.
I think some of those should be discussed in the report that you have. Some of the ones that come to my mind immediately are, and I believe there's a separate bill to this effect already, would be to make it clear that all public bodies are subject to all of the civil rights laws. And that was not clear under the existing law because of the way employer was defining things along those lines. That became even more important recently because of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision with respect to the ability of people to bring actions under the ADA against the state, where there were limitations imposed, and to where suddenly the state remedy became more significant. It just wasn't clear about whether or not, for instance, for purposes of the Fair Housing Act and some of those things, whether or not public bodies were held to the same standards as a private individual. Now, that was a substantive change by saying public bodies, and they tried to highlight that in the report, say, yeah, that's a real change. I'm trying to think off the top of my head some of the other areas where we made that sort of they made that sort of decision, the work group, in looking at changes.
Would it be possible at some point to get some analysis of those areas, kind of in bullet points, where you've done certain things?
Mr. Chair, as a matter of fact, before this whole process began, I and I believe the legislative person at Boley at the time made an outline precisely of what you're talking about, and we certainly can find that. It points out where the authorities don't run through for particular types of violations, where pieces seem to have been left out. We can provide that.
Okay. I mean, I see you didn't change things in Section 2, like the any person claiming to be aggrieved by an alleged unlawful practice may file with the Bureau. I mean, I think I remember discussions where we talked about making that a shall file before you can head off to circuit court with an action or something, but similar to that.
We did not change the exhaustion requirement.
I know. I'm just kind of toying with some of those substantive things as we go through here. So, okay, well, yeah. So there are some substantive changes in here, but they're minor, I assume, or conforming kinds of substantive changes.
Chairman, I think a good example, there was a pretty long extent discussion in the House about, right now there's some confusion in the law with respect to certain unlawful practices about what your remedies are when you sue. And it was because of the way some of those unlawful practices were designed. And after much, much discussion, it was finally decided to leave the confusion in place about the nature of the remedy, although, in fact, there was even a commission meeting at which they were extensively discussed. And the decision was because of the fear that they did not want to get into making that decision, a place where there was a clear ambiguity, but they didn't feel comfortable making the decision.
Right. I mean, a clear ambiguity would be where there is a complaint filed against an employer. To what extent does the employer's action subsequent to the notice mitigate any potential damages? If I understand currently, it's just an open ballgame. But an employer sits down with an employee that says, gee, I have a problem here and something's gone wrong and I'm going to file a complaint. The employer steps in and tries to do something to rectify or change the environment, the situation, to deal with it appropriately. There's no mitigation of any ultimate impact of a suit. So I think a lot of small businesses, unfortunately, find themselves in that trap.
Chairman, just I guess as a footnote, what we're hoping to do as a commission is to take some of these more substantive changes on that we identified as we went through this process and take on those substantive issues as a commission project in the interim. But we didn't want to touch them with this bill, and we really did try to maintain the status quo the best we could. I mean, I don't know how else to best describe it other than that, and would be happy to provide you with some of the other information of identifying some of these areas.
Yeah, well, I think you have that analysis, and you'll provide it for the committee, right? Ms. Ola-Miller, is that
correct? Yes, I would be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
Provide it to me. The rest of the committee may not care, but we'll get it done anyway. Yes, they do. I'm sure they do. Where do all my members go?
They don't care.
Okay. Shut the Judiciary Committee down for lack of interest here. Okay. Well, anything additional that you'd like to say? It's a long bill. We're going to take some time to read it.
Thank you.
Make sure that we're on target here. All right.
How much time do you need to stay on the list there?
Yeah, actually, let's go to House Bill 2646. We've got some folks there here to talk on that bill. So we'll close the public hearing, open a public hearing on House Bill 2646.
I just ripped it from me. I've never been the same since.
How are you doing, Mr. Chair?
I guess we're a subcommittee of the whole. Let's do this. I'm going to take a brief recess. We'll